Reeves, and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you the first program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Bob Bright.
The other side of the coin is, as I said to someone, you know, I really think the CSIRO should investigate how someone can possibly live to 60 just drinking Coca-Cola and eating chips. He'd never been well, you know. He'd always thought, and, you know, I'd often thought, God, man, the way you're hanging on, I'm going to go before him, you know. But anyhow.
But you haven't gone before him, and you're here today.
I am today.
The period from Laurie passing to now, does that continue to involve you in live music? Or is it backing off now?
I've always been involved with music. I mean, because I was doing voiceover work, which is...
Is this for television?
Oh,
for ads, for anything.
Ads, yeah. Yeah, from radio I went into doing voiceover work. And it meant that I didn't have to rely on music to make money, therefore I could pick and choose. I could
nice place to be.
Yeah, it's great. Except if you're not hungry, sometimes you don't push hard enough and nothing happens.
That's true too.
So you gotta, you know, it's a two-edged sword, as is everything in this duality we call life. I had a band called the Penny Arcade for a while with Graham Morgan, Derek Cateborne, Greg Cole on piano. And that sort of, you know, there's a few pirate tapes of that hanging around the internet that must have been pinched off a rehearsal session somewhere because, to my knowledge, we never recorded, you know. And, when I lived up north, I had a band that used to play all around the place. So, and I'd just drop into places and sing with people.
Yeah.
And, look, music's always been part of it, but I've never actually really relied on it since those days.
It seems, it's almost an obvious thing to say now, that the music scene, the live music scene, is so different now to how it was back in the 60s and 70s, if for no other reason than with the advent of poker machines and the clubs starting up, a lot of live venues have died away. The opportunities aren't there.
Yeah. That's...
How do you see the future of live music in Australia for the bands coming through? What do you see the challenges?
The challenge will be what it's always been, basically. You know, it's gone the full circle. From when I started with the Bowman, we had to find the hall, we had to paint, you know, do the posters, paint and do the posters. I had to find someone to work on the door. We had to somehow trick up a PA system, you know, and you had to get it together yourself. And it's back to that, you know, like it's almost back to the fact you've got to find a venue where you can do what you do and you know, you've got to arrange the posters. I mean, you don't get booked now because you're good, you get booked because you might draw 50 people or something, you know what I mean? You've almost got to guarantee that you'll drag people along to a gig before you can get a gig.
Oh, well, that's the truth. I try to get out to as much live music as I can, and that is absolutely the truth. The different bands I go around to see, they have a set audience to go around with them, because without that, they won't get the gig.
That's right.
A pretty sad state of affairs, really.
It is. Terrible. It's like the promoter doesn't want to pay for anything anymore.
The other thing that's changed, too, is that back in the 50s, well, not the 50s, but certainly the 60s and 70s, getting airplay on radio was not easy, but it was certainly possible if you had some quality music.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel, but I don't hear a lot of quality Australian music on the radio now.
No, it's not.
So, again, you might have a young band who's really talented, but what hope have they got?
No, that's it. Unless, it seems, you know, it's, a lot of bands seem to get success now by going to Germany or... You know.
Yeah, heading out of Australia.
Yeah.
What about the use of technology? Have you kept pace with that? Because, I mean, now with Facebook and YouTube and all those things, there's a pretty good mechanism there now for getting something out.
You get likes.
You get likes. That's right.
Everybody likes it, but nobody buys it.
Nobody buys it. Yeah, everybody likes it. It's fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got 900 likes.
Yeah. Where do I get the free MP3? Talking of which, free, it wasn't that long ago you bought out another CD.
Yeah.
First of all, what was behind that? What drove you to do that?
Frank Howson ran a gig at the Mimo Theatre where he got a group of various singers to do one or two of songs that he had written or part written with other people. And he chose, well, he sent me a group of songs and I chose two of them. One of them was a song he wrote with Jack Tempin, I think, guy that wrote for the Eagles. And yeah, Frank writes with all sorts of
Frank's,
people.
Yes, he's so,
there was this song called If She Were Mine. And the demo he gave me was a guy singing it a la Stevie Wonder, you know, lots of quarter tones and... And I tried to strip it back, and in my mind as a template I had Anthony Newley, you know, what kind of fool am I? And I wanted to, if she were mine, whatever it was. Anyway, to do it, it was really hard because I couldn't rehearse what I wanted to do with this version of it that had drums and
you know, locking you in.
Yeah. So Michael Oliphant was the musical director for that gig, and I said to him, look, can I spend a bit of time with you just working on it? So we did that, and I was still, you know, it was strange. Well, I couldn't get my head around it, you know. But anyway, I worked out with Michael, and on the night, killed him. You know, before it finished, you could hear women screaming. Wow.
Which hadn't happened since the 60s.
For a bloody long time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And straight after that, I think Michael went, something's going on here. Why don't we do an EP, he said to me, backstage after we'd done that. And I just... Because about 3 months behind, 3 months before that, I went to see Dave Bornstein at a gig.
Mm-hmm.
And... Michael was playing keyboard. And I said to, I think I was, it was with Michelle in those days, and I said to Michelle, that guy playing piano, that's who I wanted to be my musical director. You know, I've been looking for one of these guys all my life, you know.
Because he's really not just switched on, he's very talented.
He's a genius in many ways.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so here it was 2 months later and he's asking me to do. Yeah.
Did you have the material ready or did you...
I presented a heap of my songs to him and he chose the ones he thought that hung together, you know, told a bit of a story.
Five tracks, is that correct?
Yeah, five, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a favourite of... first of all, what was the EP called?
It was called Child of Rock and Roll because it was a song I'd written and it wasn't really even a song. It was just like I had pictured myself and I had done it at various different places where you would... walk on the stage basically unannounced, just to hear he is, you know, and I'd sing this song, you know. I'm a child of rock and roll, turned on by the radio, like a joint and enjoy a bottle of wine, you know. This is me.
I was going to say, it's your story, isn't it?
Yeah. Love to dance the night away, love to hear those guitars play, send shivers shooting up my spine. I'm a child of rock and roll, you know, just a boy who can't say no, whatever. So it was basically just, hello, it's me.
Yes.
So that's why I thought, well, that's a good place to start an album.
Indeed.
And Michael kept saying, it's too short. It's just, you know, it's just three little verses. Too short. And I'm going, well, does it matter? He said, yeah, it's too short. So my mind went to the Dead Reckoners, a group called the Dead Reckoners. They were a group of Nashville songwriters, and they did a song... when you're gone, long gone, the only thing that will have mattered is the way that we, the way that we cared and the way that we shared. When you're long gone, gone, and it sort of starts off and it builds and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then after it goes into this solo that just takes off and goes, finishes up, you know, preaching.
Yeah,
so I thought, well, I'd seen John Dallimore do that when he was playing with Max Merritt. So let's get him in.
Let's
and
do it.
And do it. So there was, Dalimore turns up for a recording session and says, well, John, I just want you to put this 4 or 5 minute solo on the end of this track, would you?
You got one in your back pocket?
Yeah. Oh, right. So, you know, we sat there. This whole recording was down at Michael's lounge room.
Mm.
Well, not lounge room, it's a studio.
Yeah.
And, you know, he listened to it, we're talking, and I sort of said, you know, the build, So he did one, and I'm like, whoa, because that guy can play guitar, you know. Four, and he's going, no, I really messed that up, let's do another one. So he finished that doing about 5 times in just 4 or 5 minutes.
And I bet that didn't get any worse.
Oh, no, they didn't get any worse. And Michael and I had the audacity to mix and match bits.
No, way to go. That's, I mean, that is the way to go.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, people would say, oh, that's cheating.
No.
That's the same as writing a book.
That's what production is, yeah.
Exactly.
Production and editing, yeah. I'm a child of rock and roll, turned on by the radio. I like a joint and enjoy a bottle of wine. Love to dance the night away. Love to hear those guitars play. Send shivers shooting up my spine. I'm a child of rock and roll. 60 years and I don't feel old. Keep those rhythms coming, I'll be fine. Love to hear that bass on line, laid down by a friend of mine. Music makes a bond that's not for breaking. Yes, I'm a child of rock and roll. Just a boy who can't say no. I'm a child of good old rock and roll. Loving good to me through the years. Been high times, there's been tears. Seen a lot as I travel around through it all. There's been the sound of good old rock and roll.
So do you have a favourite track on that EP? Or is that like saying, which is my favourite child?
I'm really happy with It's a Great Life on account of it's a song I've done, I've recorded two or three times and finally got it right with Hannah playing.
Yeah.
You know, the song's basically got four chords, and from the very first time he played it, Hannah went, and just played two. You know, it's sort of like E to F sharp. A to B.
But if you're gonna have a man play two chords, it's Hannaford, because
that's right.
That's how you.
Well, it wasn't just an E; it was like E stretched 11th.
Oh, yeah, something that nobody said.
To a B bitched minor or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he also said, "I don't like the bass." We've got Roger McLaughlin played bass on the demo we were doing. Well, it wasn't the demo; it was going to be the
track.
The track. Hannah said, oh, it's too busy, that bass line, you know, it's too busy. So I said, well, how would you play it? He said, oh, I don't know. I said, well, look, just play it on the guitar, what you'd play. And he played this line, and I said, well, look, yeah, I agree with you, you know, it's much better lilt when you're doing it. So I said, next week I'll pick you up again and we'll get a bass and put it on properly. Ringing the next week, no answer. Ringing the next week, no answer. About 4 weeks went by.
Oh.
He's nowhere to be seen. I later found out he was busking up in Cairns. Anyway, I said to Michael, hey, why can't we make MIDI out of what he played on the guitar and get a good, you know, P-bass sample?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did.
And it works.
And that's Hannaford playing bass.
Cool. That's a great story. That's
When I delivered, you know, I went round to his place and put the CD on. He looked at me and said, Ross Hannaford.
Bass?
I never played bass on a record before. He said, so I'm glad he got to do it before he left us.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
Because I love Hannaford. I've been a Hannah fan ever since I first saw him and playing in Pentridge when he was, even before, I think it was the Pink Finks or...
Yeah.
One of those, you know, and he was running around the stage at Pentridge with this silly hat with the propeller on it then, you know, long before Daddy Cool.
Yeah. We used to hang out with Stockley and a few other people like that. We used to go around to Hannaford's, Ross's parents' place, because they used to rehearse in the shed in the garage there. And of course, rehearsals were just sitting down drinking beer.
Yeah.
And he was really switched on. Lovely memory.
We were in a band called Big Dump together, and we used to have we were working at Brighton, Kyatt's Hotel in Brighton.
Mm.
At the time, you know Summer, who comes to Debs.
Mm.
Well, she was married to the guy that ran it at that time.
Okay.
And she often reminded, because we had a ride. I was about to say, where Hannaford and I wanted a room where no one would bother us during intervals. You can probably guess why.
Yeah.
And we had a bottle of Glenfiddich to drink during, this is Sunday afternoon, gig, 4 till 7, you know. And Summer reminds me sometimes, she came down and she said, oh, Don, whatever his name is, told me to tell you that your bottle of Glen Shorrock's in the room.
Okay, back to this. My favourite track on that EP is actually Elsie's song.
That's Great Life.
Yeah. Elsie. That was your mum, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's written from... Mum came to stay with us when I was living in Willie, and she had these little sayings like, oh, it's a great life if you don't weaken, you know. And oh, yeah. And then the next couple of days, I'd be saying, oh, yeah, it's a great life, you can be strong, you know. So I remember, and then I was taken her to the airport. And she's standing there with her hands behind her back, looking out at the planes while we're waiting. And she's gone, oh, it's a great life, you just take it as it comes. And I've gone, yes, that's the tag, you know. So basically the chorus of that song is made up of my mother's little platitudes. So
little philosophies.
Little philosophies.
Yeah, which is, yeah.
And I guess the rest of the song's me extrapolating on them, basically, yeah.
Bob, our time is up. We've only... probably touched, you know, the tip of a microbe in terms of your life. We can't get it in a couple of hours, an hour and a half. But what we have done, I think, is covered some of the issues and some of the periods in your time that you felt were important to you. Can I thank you for being on the program? It's been terrific.
No problem.
And what I'd like to do is to actually finish the program off with Elsie's song. So thanks for being on Listen to Older Voices.
Here it goes.
Cause it's a great life, when you don't weaken. Oh, it's a great life, if you can be strong. It's a great life, great life, great life. Oh, if you don't get beaten, then you take your life. Oh, as it comes along. This is a great life. If you don't get beaten. It's a great life, if you can be strong. It's a great life, if you don't get beaten, darling. And you take your life, oh, as it comes along.
Hi, I'm Rob
Greaves, and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you the first program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Bob Bright.